Hey Blenders, on this week's show, we review The Matrix Resurrections, we have a spoiler-filled conversation about Spider-Man No Way Home, and we play Holiday Movie Blend. Hello Blenders, and welcome to episode number 196 of Real Blend, a podcast I can't believe Danny Rojas is in the MCU. It's a movie-heavy week. We have so many movies to get to on this week's podcast. You guys won't believe it. Like, there's a staggering amount of films to get to, and really important ones, too. No guests this week, because we're going to be digging into Spider-Man No Way Home spoilers. But we are going to get to, later, a review of The Matrix Resurrections. It's Resurrections, Gabe. In the notes, it says Revolutions.
I do that.
Too many
every,
R's.
I do
no,
that every
we're,
week.
We're actually talking about the third film.
Oh, we yeah, are.
I get confused. Yeah.
I do it every week.
I honestly forget which one is out now. Yeah. Like, there's all R's.
Resurrection. I've forgotten the one that's out now, too, coincidentally. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, joined as always by my great friend, Kevin McCarthy, Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kev. How are you?
Sean, Jacob, Gabriel, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to you and everyone out there. And this is our last episode of the year. But as Sean said, we have like eight movies to talk about. It's going to be a very dense episode. So
it will. And you'll notice that Jake Hamilton, a Fox 32 in Chicago, has a different backdrop. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
Hi, buddy. Yeah, I'm here in Texas visiting the family through Christmas. I love that... Kevin got, I'd like to introduce my great friend, Kevin McCarthy, and
yeah,
I got,
yeah.
Also Jake's here.
Yeah, yeah. Also, it's appropriate.
Yeah. Well, it's also because you've been eating so much Whataburger, we don't know who you are anymore.
Also the hat, like Jake's rocking the hat for a long time now. What's going on? You ready to get a haircut? What's your story?
Yeah, look at the hair, it's...
When you don't have to be camera ready, it's the hat.
I mean, I'll go. I just didn't want to shame. I know that your head of hair isn't right. As thick and voluptuous.
Listen,
as,
I got a haircut.
As the golden locks.
I still have hair.
You got a great head
I
of
did,
hair.
I did get a haircut. Yes, this is very true.
You've got a great. You look fantastic.
Thank you.
Did you get a haircut
that.
For Spider-Man?
Fishing for compliments. No, I got a haircut because I was out of quarantine finally, and I was able to go and interact with the public. So I got out of the house.
Jake was channeling his inner Gabe with his beanie.
Gabe does rock a hat.
Gabe wore a hat. How come Gabe needs to wear a hat?
He's not on camera. Not on camera for this episode.
Oh, Gabe's got a head of hair too. Oh my god!
Look at that. That's outstanding.
Gabe's got a. I don't think I realized how voluptuous Gabe's head of hair is.
It's fantastic. Yes, I'm
all the more
jealous.
Reason to go to YouTube for these things.
Well, listen, Jake. I'm glad you brought that up because if you're watching us on YouTube,
I'm the king of the segue.
Hello, thank you. Head down and hit like and subscribe. We are catching up with a ton of followers and bringing people into the fold. If you want to join us in our video form, if you happen to be listening in an audio format right now, go to youtube.com/realblendpodcast and you can watch the show. And quite often when we have guests, including a bonus episode guest that we're going to have next week, Mr. Oliver Stone, that'll be on video. I'll tease that a little bit later in the episode. Have you signed up for Real Blend Premium?
Hope you had a wonderful time with Oliver Stone.
With Real Blend Premium, you get an ad-free version of the show. You get an additional show that drops every Monday. And this week we're going to be playing, we're going to be having a mailbag. Oh, you get fun merchandise like that sometimes. Well, premium people get access to the merchandise at a shop.
Well, no, everybody does. What are you saying? Well,
I don't know.
Merchandise is available for everyone.
I didn't know that.
And
either.
Also, we don't send you free mugs. So
we don't. Just yeah, Kevin.
Now I'm going to take that in post. I'm going to say that really quickly, like the end of an ad, where they're like, the FDA does argument.
Yeah. No, no, seriously, we really don't send you mugs.
Yeah.
I paid for that mug, by the way.
He did, yes.
I did.
And, even the hosts don't get free
and
mugs.
We're on the show.
I paid for my mug.
Check the description of where you are currently listening to find out how to sign up for Real Blend Premium. Let's get to the poll this week. So, Tom Holland has completed his first trilogy. First of, I think many. We'll discuss that later on. Which now puts him in the pantheon of the existing Spider-Man actors. So we wanted to ask the folks. Yes, Kevin.
I have a quick question, and this has already been figured out, but I was very confused by this.
Okay.
Amy Pascal told Eric Davis at Fandango that there was going to be three more Spider-Man movies with Tom Holland. Did she say that before Tom Holland knew that?
Did she say three? She did say working on the next trilogy, didn't we? I think she was forcing Marvel's hand a little
bit. Okay, cool. All right, we'll get to that. All right,
Yeah. Because
just curious.
It's negotiating tactics, and I think Amy was keeping Kevin Feige's, not Kevin McCarthy's, feet to the fire. So,
okay.
Jake, we're going to ask you this one.
You always give me the hard ones.
We asked the people, who is your favorite Spider-Man actor? We have three to choose from: Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, and Tom Holland. First, tell me where you think the people went, Jake, and then I want to know your answer to the question.
I really think, just by nature of what's most recent and just the surge of popularity and positive vibes surrounding No Way Home, I do think more people probably went Tom Holland, though I also think that there's love for all three for three different reasons. So I would say Tom Holland, but not that he, I don't think he like took it and ran away with it.
Incorrect. He got 48%, which is a lot higher.
I know who was number one.
Than most everybody. Well, no, Holland. Tom Holland got 48%. Yes, yeah. He was number one.
But number two was Andrew Garfield, though.
He was number three.
Oh, what?
He was number three in the poll. Tobey Maguire got 28% and Andrew got 24%, which I do find very strange because you're right. There has been a sort of renaissance of recognizing Andrew's contributions to the Spider-Man franchise. And so I was surprised to see him get that low, because if I had to pick myself, he would be my choice. I love Tom Holland. I think Holland's great.
Oh,
I think Andrew's terrific, though.
I'm Holland all the way.
Are you?
No question.
Are we talking best or favorite? Are we talking best or favorite?
This one says, who is your favorite Spider-Man actor?
Favorite, I'm going Toby.
Really? Yeah. Interesting.
Ooh. I think it's just the nostalgia. I don't know. You know I am a sucker for nostalgia.
You are. See? That's very true. It's why you like Rise of Skywalker.
Favorite, I'm Holland.
Honestly, that's actually like, that's not even probably a knock. That's actually probably very true.
It's very true. That movie is nostalgia heavy. Yeah.
It's like, hey, remember those things you loved? Here they are.
All right, let's get into...
And they fly now, you know?
They fly now.
We're still doing this joke
2 years later. We're still doing
Spider-Man No Way Home spoiler chat. And I get to go first because I did not see
it
the last time.
Why do you get to go first?
Well, Jake...
You don't even like Spider-Man.
Because the last time we reviewed...
You missed the movie before it came out. Like, we all saw it before you did.
I was the last one to go. I really didn't care at all.
And we're never going to let you forget that.
No, you shouldn't. That honestly should be something...
And Sean, how many times have you seen it now?
Twice. I've seen it twice. Well, two and a half times.
Just like me.
And I want to go again this weekend, if not for Christmas. Ugh, God. Stupid Christmas.
What? You said you were going this weekend. Did you misspeak because you forgot Christmas?
No. I said Sunday because I knew at least that would be like after Christmas. Like after
so Christmas
rush.
Is in the way of you going to see Spider-Man a third and a half time.
Yes. True. Although I really just
want
to.
His family understand.
They really do. I want to see the second half of it. Let's get into the spoiler chat and I'll explain why I want to get into the second half of it. You guys tried to warn me in advance that this movie was going to be everything that I was hoping for. And it's not even fair to say that, you know, that it's my favorite movie of all time. Like it's crazy, crazy.
Kevin said it was going to be your favorite movie of all time.
It's interesting because I had two different experiences with it, and the second time, I think the emotion finally hit me, because the first time I was just in shock.
It's overwhelming.
It's too much. And like, it's so amazing that even to the point where by the end of the movie, you remember that like they introduced they brought Daredevil in, and that's like a blip.
Oh, yeah.
Like you just even forget that that even happened, even though that's an incredible scene. I loved the way that they brought the villains back. I thought it was a terrific way to introduce all those characters. I thought giving Tom the opportunity to want to cure them and send them all back was very character appropriate. Mm-hmm. There's a great moment where Molina says, like, you could have left us to die, you know, after he fights Doctor Strange. And Zendaya's like, yeah, but that's not what he does. Like, he wouldn't do that to you guys. And I think that speaks very highly to who Tom Holland's Peter Parker is. Defoe is the MVP.
Oh my God.
Of this movie.
No one can argue that that's a paycheck for him. Like he,
no.
And I'm saying you saw the quote where he said like, I'm going to do the stunts.
Yeah.
That fight in the condominium between him and Tom Holland is unbelievably great.
Yeah.
It's
that
so laugh.
That shot where he's go. Oh my God. When he transitions, when you realize that he's not Norman, that he's the Goblin.
Yes.
Oh,
it's all in the eyes. It's all in the eyes.
Yeah,
you see him switch
in
the eyes. Yeah. Like literally, like it's such a brilliant, subtle transition, but it's terrifying. Like that is, it's such a brutal character too. Yeah. I rewatched Tobey's first Spider-Man over the weekend. This movie and the original Sam Raimi film and two, they're very violent. Like, I forgot how brutal the Maguire one was. Yeah. Like, especially with the goblins.
That last
stuff.
Death mm-hmm. scene, the goblins' death yeah. scene in the Raimi Spider-Man is pretty rough. I mean, even that's what Holland said in my interview, is that he wished his suit got torn up more often. Like we forget Tobey Maguire's suit is freaking shredded by the time that movie's over.
And I think that fight is when it should have happened.
Yeah.
Because, like, that goblin... When he wraps his legs around Osborn's face and he's punching him, and Norman's face like changes to a smile in the middle of getting punched.
Yeah.
Oh.
Terrifying. Like,
horrifying.
I thought he was amazing. I really loved what Jamie Foxx was able to do with his new additions to it. You didn't like Jamie Foxx?
I felt like he was being. And granted, I've only seen Amazing Spider-Man 2 one time.
Yeah.
So I don't 100% remember of how he. Is that how he played the part in that one? Because to me, it just felt like he was Jamie Foxx in this movie. Like,
no.
He was, I think, to me, the only weak link of the villains. Because the whole time I was like, oh, like, I just thought that some of his line deliveries were not my favorite.
But he does have one of the best lines in the movie, which is the Miles Morales reference,
that
which
was
is really
fantastic.
Cool.
I recently rewatched the film with my dad, and there were moments where I was like, okay, what of Jamie Foxx could I cut? And there were a couple of lines I was like, ooh, I would have cut that from Jamie Foxx.
Okay.
Now, the Miles Morales thing was great. And there were a couple of things that, like, I thought he nailed, but... I didn't see Electro. I saw Jamie Foxx.
Well, I can't argue that because he does definitely play it that way. In Amazing Spider-Man 2, he really tries to play like a
character. Nerdy.
Yeah.
Right.
See, I wish we'd gotten that.
I think he kind of thought like it didn't work when I tried it the first time. So now I'm just going to be Jamie Foxx.
Yeah, but in Amazing Spider-Man 2, the arc for him was like he was like a nerdy guy working at the, right, and essentially he has like glasses and he's like super like not confident at all. And then once he transitions into Electro, he does become a little more like that, right?
A little more, but he's still, he's blue, he's still,
I feel like in this he turned it up to 11. Like, I thought he was full-blown Jamie Foxx in this.
Maybe.
And granted, we're talking about a movie that's going to be on my top 10 list this year. Like, I'm not... knocking it, but
sure.
The reason I go as far as saying it's not perfect is because of a thing like I didn't like how Jamie Foxx delivered his lines.
So we got tickets to go on Thursday at 4 because I wanted to see it as early as possible and avoid Portland.
What was your crowd?
Well, this is what I was going to get to. The Thursday crowd was okay, not that good. You know, they were okay. And we had tickets for Friday night, which I had bought a while ago when I thought the family would go. IMAX and a Friday night crowd, 7 o'clock. That was the concert atmosphere crowd.
That's awesome.
Like, that was the one that was just, it was everything, you know?
Yeah, I still
like,
haven't gotten that. I still haven't gotten
also,
that yet.
Oh, really? It's very important to note for people out there listening, if you see this movie in IMAX, it's full IMAX the whole time.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So, and what I mean by full IMAX, I know we talk about aspect ratios in the show, but if you go to like an AMC or a Regal, their IMAX is 1.90, which is the aspect ratio the entire time it fills the whole screen. Yeah. But if you went to like a science museum, it wouldn't fill the 1.43 because they didn't shoot it that way. But if you go to like a normal AMC or whatever, it will fill your whole screen. So see it in IMAX because it is literally shot and formatted to take up the entire screen. It's pure immersion. It's unbelievable.
So let's get to the moments when Andrew and Toby come back because they're fantastic. I really like the use of the sling ring, you know, to have Ned bring them back. I thought that was a clever way to introduce them. Yes, Gabriel.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because we're on that, one thing that I know at least Jake and I had discussed in side chat was we were not expecting them to be in it as much. Like, we thought maybe they were gonna be the end of the third act. They're gonna come in and help save the day, and it's gonna be fun. What were your expectations? And as it was unfolding and you were realizing that you were going to spend so much time with these former actors and now sort of current actors, what was your reaction? Were you surprised by that, or were you hopeful that was going to be the case all along?
I had heard, just from being like close to the ground on a lot of this stuff, I'd heard a couple of different things already. I kind of had heard the sling ring rumor, like that Ned was going to get access to it. So when Peter pulls it off of Doctor Strange's hand... coming out of the mirror dimension, I thought, oh, that's interesting because Ned will probably use it later. But I didn't know the context. I didn't know how Ned was actually going to do it. I had heard that the three of them were going to get a scene where they do science together. That's all I'd heard. So I didn't really know necessarily what they were going to be working on, but I love the fact that it was the cure for each of the different villains. And I love the fact that each of the
How do people
Spider-Man,
know this? Like, how did people know that they were going to do
no
science
idea.
Together?
I think that a lot of these rumors, the quote-unquote rumors, get leaked by people who work at visual effects houses. I think that there's people who are working right up until the last minute on a lot of these scenes, so they see whole chunks of the movie, and then they just go home and they tell somebody. They tell a friend, they tell a family member, and then it gets out. That's where a lot of this spoiler information comes from, people who are working on visual
effects. I'm bummed you knew that information. I didn't know that information.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
I was okay with all that. I honestly didn't mind, because in that point, I just wanted to see how it played out.
Yeah.
But everything at the Statue of Liberty, with all of their conversations, and the scene where the one that I keep... I'm just as bad as everybody else with piracy. I'm going back to YouTube and rewatching scenes that I can't get enough of. And the conversation of them saying, like, we need to figure out how to trust our tingles and work together. And then, of
Peter
course,
three.
The spider, the, yeah, Peter 1, Peter 2, Peter 3 is just the greatest line delivery ever. And then, of course, you know, them running and diving off the platform and landing on the crown. And it's just, it's fucking everything. It's everything. And I can't believe what blows my mind. And Gabe, to your point, like, there's been so many of these other examples of these legacy franchises that bring back the existing characters, and it's only, like, for a glorified moment. And in my spoiler-filled review of Ghostbusters, I mentioned that, you know, bringing those guys back in the final minute, and then I got slammed in the comments for, like, I haven't seen Ghostbusters yet, thanks for ruining for me. That's been out for a while.
Dude, whenever I did the junket and asked the new cast about the old guys coming, not the old guys, but the original guys coming back,
yeah,
and they all talked about it freely, and I got also slammed in my comments. And I was like, dude, there was a Vanity Fair piece on set with Bill Murray from like a year plus ago.
Yeah, before we even recorded that episode, I'm pretty sure the three of them were on like the Tonight Show talking.
Yeah, they did Tonight Show appearance.
Yes, exactly.
It's crazy.
But I loved that they were in it a lot more. Like, I loved that they were part of the story. You know, it was a narrative reason to bring
them
back.
Felt like they cared.
Yes,
felt like the actors cared.
But it was, I thought it did an amazing job of bringing closure to Andrew with some of his open-ended stuff. The moment when he saves Zendaya was the moment that Michelle in the theater literally burst into tears. Literally burst into tears. Because she
his
turns
face.
To me and she
oh
was
my
just
God,
like,
and he can't even speak.
Yeah.
It's such a, oh my God, when he's holding her.
Yeah.
It's... What a, I mean, what, see, to me, and I wanted to mention this because I used the word cathartic when we were talking about this movie last week, and I couldn't really dive into why, but like that scene in particular, and then the what's interesting about Spider-Man, and I love about the villains like Doc Ock specifically and Goblin, and I rewatched the Maguire films recently, is that like there is that interesting humanity in that individual before they become evil. And with Doc Ock specifically, remember at the end of 2 when he like takes himself into the, you know, into whatever that thing was called. I don't know what that big ball of fire or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then goes and then drowns with it. Like, I actually felt for Molina's Doc Ock in that moment, because you understand that, especially with Goblin. Like, remember when, like, in the first Tobey Maguire film, when Goblin, like, first transitions and kills that guy in the lab, and then he's, like, genuinely, like, petrified when he learns the next day the guy died?
Yeah.
Like, that's... I always found that fascinating, because they don't know. It's a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of thing.
Yeah.
And for me, what I love about this film is it gave you the ability to understand that the villains were, it wasn't by choice. It was by, you know, science or whatever brought them into that element. And for Holland's character to give them that opportunity, I mean, Aunt May really becomes the moral backbone to this entire story. That one little comment she gives to Holland, you know, in the movie about like, you know, what you're supposed to do. And like, you think, oh, come on, he has to send the villains back. And then you understand, like, these are human beings. And that's what really kind of like blew my mind in terms of the cathartic nature of it, is like, I just found myself like wanting this for villains in a weird way. And I think that's when you have brilliant writing and layered characters. But the saving of Zendaya, like everything got to kind of go through a full cycle of emotion and full arcs.
Yeah.
But in a weird way, I told you guys this over text, my favorite scene in that entire film is when Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield do the back crack.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. I just love that moment, because it was just like, I just loved seeing them in that atmosphere.
Yeah.
But overall, yeah, I'm with you, man. But the cathartic nature of this film, and it was well-deserved. It was all narrative-based. It wasn't just a gimmick to bring them back. It was purely... good storytelling. And
well,
I John Watts kind of pulled off the impossible, in my opinion.
Kevin, you mentioned like, oh, I'm sorry, Sean, go ahead.
I was gonna say, there's something really beautiful about that. These three actors are the only three men who have played Spider-Man in live action, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
in a feature film. So they're able to relate to things, you know, like they're bringing their relation to the franchise, to being in the franchise, and also as their characters, like in the story kind of thing. So there's a moment right before the backbreaking thing, there's a moment when Andrew says, you know, Max was such a really nice guy. Talking about Jamie Foxx's thing. Max was such a really nice guy. He was such a sweetheart until he fell into that vat of electrical eels. And Toby kind of laughs and he goes, that'll do it. You know, like they just have this
experience. You fall into.
As Spider-Man.
It's, it's so smart.
For me, I love the cathartic moment between Tobey Maguire and Alfred Molina. Like when Alfred Molina was back, not as Doc Ock, but as Otto Octavius. And just when he says, like you've grown up, like it's just, you know, he just hasn't seen him. And he's like, how are you? And you kind of remember that these two, like, had respect for each other at the beginning of Spider-Man 2. Like, they were friends. Like Peter really wanted to learn under Octavius. And Octavius had a lot of respect for Peter. And I feel like we hadn't seen them together. And, you know, not even Spider-Man Doc Ock, but Peter Parker and Otto Octavius. And that line where he says, like, trying to be better.
Yeah,
I loved that little moment between the two of them. I thought that was great. Okay, I'm not going to try to like rain on the parade, but if I had to knock one more, like, section of the film that I thought was clunky,
the middle,
and even seeing the gathering of the villains from that moment where Electro shows up, basically just about to the apartment, I thought. I thought it was clunky. I thought the writing was kind of clunky. I thought the dialogue between all the villains was choppy and clunky, and there were some jokes there that didn't land for
them
me. A lot of them belonging to Jamie Foxx, but just like it's a 20-minute section, maybe 25-minute section of the film that the first time I saw it, I just thought like, ooh, what's this seems off. And I thought I had the exact same feelings whenever, because I remember thinking, okay, well, maybe once I see it in the context of the film that I know that it is, it'll be better. When I saw it yesterday with my dad, and I felt the same way. There are so many moments I was like, God, I would have cleaned this up by about 75%.
Okay. You're not wrong. I definitely felt that lag a little bit. I have a question for Sean, actually, because I'm trying to understand this. So theoretically, so from what I understand, when you watch the film, the villains are brought back the moment before they die, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so how does that work? How did the spell enable them to bring them back the moment before they die?
I think that might just be
like a writing thing.
For its convenience. It's supposed to be is a spell.
Cuz the idea too that if they put them, when they put them back, they put them back to the moment before they die.
You could argue that you could argue the science of it, quote unquote, is that the multiverse leans into the most convenient way. Like, instead of completely breaking the multiverse where it goes, okay, if we pull them from this instant, then that universe has to change from what is already written, quote unquote. You could say that, like, oh, it pulled them from there because that was the easiest point. That was the path of least resistance the power of the multiverse to pull it through.
You could also kind of argue that, like, if the idea is that they're pulling him from the universe when they knew that he was Peter Parker, because it's him saying that one line in the middle of the spell.
Oh, that's really great.
Oh,
then
wow.
They can't be dead. You know, they'd have to be alive to kind of know who he is.
Interesting.
And they all find out at, like, the end of the movie kind of
thing? That's interesting.
A little bit, sure.
Yeah.
Because Lizard doesn't die at the end of The Amazing Spider-Man. He ends up in Ravencroft.
Does Electro die?
Electro kind of, like, shorts out, They kind of ramp him up with so much power that he kind of explodes. But Lizard even says something in No Way Home where he says to Max, he's like, do you know if I died? And then they kind of don't answer it. They just sort of glance over it. So, I don't know. The science
How do you think, Risa Fonz and, was it Thomas Jane? Thomas Hayden Church. Just showed up on set. Like, they're like, hey, we'll put you in front of a green screen. And
one quick scene.
No. That's all recycled footage. When you see each of them turn into their human counterparts at the end, when they are each healed, that's existing footage from Amazing Spider-Man and Spider-Man 3.
Really?
Wait, did Hayden Church and Risa Fonz voice it?
Yeah.
Okay.
They did their dialogue, but they did their dialogue from sound stages, like at home in COVID.
Wow. I also thought the Green Goblin scene on the dumpster, was that a lot of actual footage from the little chair scene, because they're mirroring that for sure, but it felt so familiar that I was like, is this the actual footage from that scene? I haven't gone back to rewatch.
Maybe that might, because it did. It looks exactly like it, with the mask talking to him.
And it's and it's like set up the same way. Like the angles are very similar from what I remember. Like maybe flipped.
But I think that there's a lot of that movie that's assembled in a way that we don't realize. Like I think a lot of stuff was shot, probably with the villains too, was shot in like pieces, and kind of assembled in a rough kind of cut.
By the way, Aunt May's death scene.
Yeah.
That was when really she stood up.
Yeah.
When she stood up, like you could tell something was wrong with her. But like what's brilliant about that moment is emotionally as an audience member, you're in a push pull because you know she's been injured and she doesn't seem normal. And she's like breathing in a weird way. And you're like, and part of you is like, oh, she's getting up. She's fine. But then the back of your mind, you're like, no. This is like the Uncle Ben death.
They're kind of love Jon Favreau's reaction to that moment. That when Jon Favreau pulls up and you see that, like, he understands what's going on. Sean, I have a question for you.
Sure.
I just saw you tweet, and I didn't even think about this or realize this, that John Watts has not done a single interview up to this point. So what would be your first question? What would you ask him?
Oh, jeez. That's a great question. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. I mean, it would be something along the lines of bringing Andrew and Toby back.
Like what are those phone calls like, or who do you have to go? Do you have to go through their publicist, or do you have to go through their agent?
You should ask him if Mark Webb got to make a Spider-Man movie. Ooh. Would John Watts get to make an Electro movie?
Oh! Yeah, and then you say how many watts of electricity is in Electro in the scene? See, these are the great questions that we.
It's a shame he skipped the interviews. You know.
You know what? I would ask him about the creation of what is without question my favorite scene, which is the final swing. And the homemade suit and everything about that.
I love the blue. I love the blue
perfection. So, all right, let's get to the end credits. And
the black suit was turned inside out, right? Of the red, the black suit was just inside out.
That was so cool because like we were all talking about this new suit, but it's just the old suit inside out.
And I didn't realize the first time I saw it was the second time watching when he goes to feast and he sees Norman with Aunt May. That's when I got an up close shot of that inside out suit,
you
and you
can
see the wires. Yeah.
I thought that was so cool.
That's a really nice touch.
Yeah.
So, in a New York Times interview, Kevin Feige and Amy Pascal gave a couple of quotes about the future of, and Kevin said that they are already in active development on the fourth Spider-Man with Tom Holland, and the reason why he said that is because he didn't want to have any kind of this protracted, you know, confusion. In the fan base about whether Sony and Marvel were going to continue to play together. So Holland is at least getting another one. There is this talk, like Kevin McCarthy brought up, about whether it's a trilogy or not. Amy Pascal seems to make it like she wants it to last forever, which of course she does, because look at how much money this thing made. And clearly fans are buying into what the two of them do together. But there's a lot of things that can now be explored in really interesting ways, because in the Tom Hardy scene, they left the symbiote behind. I hope they don't rush right into the symbiote storyline. I don't really want that next. I feel like we've seen that a couple of times already, both with the Spider-Man 3 and then the two Venom movies. So I kind of want to see Spider-Man in his red and blue and doing some other Spider-Man things before the symbiote comes into it. But that is a very deliberate line by Tom Hardy when he's like, maybe I should go to New York and see this Spider-Man guy. And then he gets beamed away. That's so that the little piece of symbiote on the bar, you know, will seek out Spider-Man and track him down somehow.
Do we get an Andrew Garfield third Amazing Spider-Man? Because like his performance, this is like another reason the movie was cathartic, because I don't love Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2. I mean, obviously Gwen's death scene is an incredible sequence, but like, I just don't feel like he was ever, like even the score for his movies, the Horner score, and I love James Horner, I just don't love the score.
I like his theme a lot.
It's not Elfman or Giacchino level, and I love James Horner, I just don't think his theme is as good as Maguire's or Holland's. But my question is now is, like the way Garfield played Spider-Man and Peter Parker in No Way Home, like I felt like that was what we were always supposed to get from him. Like he's just a brilliant actor, and like that's the guy, that's the character, that's the movie that he deserved to be in. So like now I know it's trending everywhere. Like, do you think they theoretically could just hop back into his universe, right?
Of course,
start from the moment he goes back.
Well, I've seen a lot of people say that, like, what if we said that Hardy and Garfield were in the same universe?
You could do that. Sure.
But Holland is already in
No,
wait, wait,
no,
I thought the end of Venom 2
he goes
was
back
him
to
watching...
his universe.
Because
he comes into Holland's and basically he's talking to Danny, Danny Rojas.
He's
saying, wait, what's going on in this universe? Explain this to me. And then he gets zapped back to his world. So what if his world was Garfield's world?
There's a lot of Daily Bugle references and J. Jonah Jameson references. And Andrew could very easily just be in New York in the Venom movies because Venom's out in San Francisco. So yes, you could very easily do that. One of the only reasons why, if there's enough fan interest, and there seems to be right now, and if Sony is really smart and they wanted to make money, they'd be backing up, the quote-unquote Brinks truck, to Andrew's doorstep.
Announce it now. No,
well, here's the thing.
We're good on Toby.
Are we? I'd rather see Toby do Spider-Man 4 than Andrew do Spider-Man 3.
Oh, no. I would see Andrew do Spider-Man 3, no question. I'm cool with Toby and the closure he gets in No Way Home. It's Garfield that I think deserves another great movie. And
well, you know what's interesting? This is the point that I was going to bring up. Andrew's 38, Toby's 46, right? So which one seems viable to do another film? I guess it's Andrew. Andrew's also theoretically going to be getting an Oscar nomination, for Tick, Tick, Boom.
And he deserves to win.
And should be moving on to more prestigious pictures, right? Does he have to come back to a franchise that broke his heart? I don't think he has to.
If I'm him, I say, look, I got my
No Way Home is
pretty
good moment to go out on. Yeah,
it really is.
We'll get to, I know we have a couple more questions we want to answer in this segment before we move on. But I'll end on this. To that point, I think that it would be beneficial for Sony to differentiate itself from the MCU Spider-Man if he were older. I think 38 is old enough. But I think people loved the Jake Johnson, Peter Parker in Spider-Verse. And that sort of aged up, sort of beaten down. Or it doesn't necessarily have to be that tone. But I think if it was Spider-Man in a completely different part of his life is how you could really make an interesting Spider-Man movie that sits alongside the MCU Spider-Man.
Yeah, for sure. And
what's going on with Tobey Maguire and MJ? It implied they're together, but they said that they've had some issues.
He says it's complicated.
It's complicated. I'd love to know what's going on there.
I know.
Maybe Raimi will answer it in the Multiverse of Madness.
God, Multiverse of Madness!
You could finally bring Shailene Woodley's Mary Jane back and put her into the next Andrew one if you wanted to, if she was...
And then he looks at her and goes, oh... You're my MJ.
That would be really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason why, the age thing doesn't really matter is because we just found out today that Michael Keaton is going to continue to play Batman.
He's
70, so, who knows. But last question, and this is a really interesting one because the Doctor Strange spell said that everyone on the planet is going to forget that Spider-Man, that Peter Parker is Spider-Man. So do you guys think that the MCU built that in as a safety net? So that the other people who are off planet, Carol Danvers,
that could be very interesting. Thor shows up and goes wait, what? What do you mean you don't know Peter Parker? What do you mean you don't know?
That could and be Nick Fury at the end of Captain Marvel.
I think who it'll be because of the Endgame. Even just that one moment was so huge for people. Danvers. Peter Parker or whatever she's. I think it's gonna be Carol Danvers. And Carol Danvers is majorly powerful. Everyone thinks that they understand her word is I think well respected, especially with Nick Fury. So I think that'll be the person that's the catalyst for that.
What's the deal with MJ and Ned? They're gonna be in Boston.
I think they're out of the franchise.
You think they're done?
No.
Yeah, I said this in the text thread and I think that they're done.
Way.
And I know Kevin disagrees. But
no
I think
way.
That they, well, not that they won't be used later. I think that they
could
absolutely
wicked
come back
crime
later.
In
John
wicked
Watts crime. Battle-on'd both of them.
I think he's going to battle on. He might
There's
battle
no
on both of them.
Way Zendaya is not going to be in other Tom Holland Spider-Man movies. There's no way.
I'm willing
There's
to
no
bet
way.
You right now. I will bet you right now that she's not in the next one.
All right, I'll bet you $20.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay,
Zendaya,
yeah.
That was such a tragic, a wonderful, beautiful, tragic ending to that relationship.
Yeah.
I would
be,
no. Yes. I'm saying I would be bummed if he didn't get to win her back kind
but
of thing.
But not
I'm very
right
much
away.
Attached to the two.
If they
not
do
right
it,
away.
If they do it in the next movie, it deflates the tragedy of that.
He meets his Gwen Stacy, falls in love with Gwen Stacy, and all of a sudden MJ transfers to his school.
Well, right. Or okay, how about this? He meets his Gwen Stacy, he falls in love with his Gwen Stacy, and then Carol Danvers returns and tells everybody that Peter Parker is Spider-Man.
Oh.
And then Zendaya's MJ is like, oh, wait a second. We had this whole relationship, and now he's torn between two people.
Oh, my God!
There we go.
I'm emotionally invested in this made-up story now.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Really briefly, before we move off of Marvel, I want to talk about the Hawkeye series finale and just sort of wrap up the reactions to that. If you want to see my full-on reaction to every single episode, we have that on the Cinema Blend YouTube channel. So go over there and check out that series. I want you guys to watch it. I know you both have sort of signed off on it. Jake, you tried to start watching it.
I watched the first two and just was just... I'm sorry, it seemed bad.
No, the second episode is the worst of the series. And from 3 through 6, it gets really exciting.
I do not make an appearance on Sean's YouTube series, so I will tell the two of you. I really love this one. I think that this... I haven't seen the finale.
Other people I talk to whose opinion I also value... tell me it's terrible.
I don't know why Sean loves or likes it. I actually don't know where he's at because I haven't finished his... I haven't seen the finale, so I haven't watched his finale episode of his series. Go check it on CinemaBlend's channel or the description below. What I love about it is that I think it is more in line with what I would like these series to be, which is I don't want them to be moving the universe along necessarily beyond like a character introduction standpoint. I love them as sort of one-shot comics, which is what this is. This is can Dad come home for Christmas? However, Dad is Hawkeye and he has Hawkeye problems.
Mm-hmm. See, I really want more Loki. Like, oh, you need to see this to understand.
We'll probably
going
end up getting
MCU.
Both, but I think if you set your expectations at I'm going to get a Christmas story about can Dad make it home in time for Christmas, and the problems are Hawkeye's superhero problems. It's a ton of fun for me.
And now let's shift over to movies that are coming to theater, starting with the animated Sing 2, which Jake Hamilton went out of his way to go see because he's a huge fan of the franchise. Jakey, as the resident Sing fanatic, how was the sequel? Did it live up to your expectations?
I'm sorry.
How was Bono?
He was so good, it's like he wasn't even there.
You too?
Look, here's what I would say. I actually like Sing 1 and 2. I like the big musical numbers. They always pick really fun poppy songs, usually ones of which I like. The performances are always fun, and watching a fun musical performance, whether or not it's performed by animated animals, is still fun to me. And there is a lot of humor in these movies that makes me laugh. So I look at it through the perspective of, if I had a kid who wanted to go see it and I sat in a theater for 90 minutes and watched this movie with them, would I be clawing my eyes out? No, I would actually enjoy myself for the time in which I went and saw it.
Okay. You would sing too with your kids.
I would sing as well.
Netflix has the Adam McKay movie Don't Look Up coming to theaters. This is the Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence one that's about an asteroid coming to Earth. It's been joked as Armageddon with a brain. But my bold takeaway with this is that it's really hard to make jokes about a clueless media and a government that's obsessed with the midterm elections and overlooking science when we just lived through everything that we lived through with the Trump administration and the pandemic. And, you know, not to make this political in any way, shape, or form, but like when that stuff dominates your news cycle on a nightly basis and then you try to watch a comedy that tries to make all that stuff funny, it wasn't funny to me. So it fell really flat. And I was pretty disappointed because I really like McKay and I like The Big Short, which I thought was really educational as it was really funny and sort of took a sword to a lot of that stuff. I liked Vice a lot, which I thought, you know, took his political lens and really did focus on some great performances and character development and saw all of that through a different lens. I just didn't think Don't Look Up worked on that level. And so I was a little bit disappointed.
I also love The Other Guys, by the way.
It's also a really funny,
great McKay movie, yeah.
Yeah. Kev, where are you on the Tinder Bar? George Clooney's film.
Yeah, I believe it's pronounced the Tinder Bar.
It's an interesting film because I understand the criticisms for it, and I think that there are like some of the writing and some of the performances like could have been slightly better in my opinion. But when I look back at Tinder Bar, I specifically look at Ben Affleck. I think it's one of the best performances of his career. Like, I think he's just genuinely incredible in the film. And Uncle Charlie, the character he plays, like, for people who aren't aware, like, essentially, there's a young boy in the film whose father is absent. He's a radio host. So he grows up around his uncle, Uncle Charlie. And Ty Sheridan plays him later on in life. And then Ron Livingston does the voice for him in the generation later or whatever. But I thought Affleck was so great that that's what made the movie work for me. I just like spending time with that character. Uncle Charlie kind of reminded me of my own Uncle Steve, and just in the sense of like he was the cool uncle that you'd want, you could do stuff with and hang out with. So to me, that's really, really where the movie worked. Was anytime Affleck was on screen, which is a lot, I think he's wonderful. I think the film itself is fine, but I think he's better than the movie. So I think it's worth seeing for Affleck's performance in general.
I cannot recommend Denzel Washington's Journal for Jordan. I like Michael B. Jordan a lot. I think it's a really sweet story, but I think it's told like a Hallmark film. Not even as good as necessarily a Hallmark film. I don't quite get how Denzel fumbled this material. He's directed things before in the past that have been successful.
I don't see what attracted him to, in the first place, to be honest with you.
Well, in his defense, it's a great story because the truth story behind it, like, and I agree, the film isn't told as well as the story deserves to be told, which is strange because, like, Denzel was directed before Great Debaters and Antoine Fisher. And obviously, he's been around great directors. Yeah, and it didn't feel like an extremely well-made movie. But at the end of the day, performances are great in it. I thought Michael B. Jordan was great. I'm trying to remember her last name off the top of my head, was fantastic as well. Is it Shantae Adams?
Someone, I think it's Adams. Shantae Adams. Yeah. I believe it is,
And she was great. So, but for people who don't know the story, it's a great story. It's about a first sergeant, Charles Monroe King. He was killed in battle in Baghdad. And right before his passing, he had been filling out a journal for his son, Jordan, which had all these life lessons in them. And that's that. I love that story. I love the idea of a kid being able to. So to answer Jake's question about what attracted Denzel to the movie, it's a great story. It just wasn't executed in the best way possible, unfortunately. Sadly. But I'm honored that I know the story. I mean, he seemed like a really awesome guy. I wish I could have met Charles Monroe King. So I'm happy to know the story, and I'm happy to know that he existed and what he did. But I do wish the film was better. I really do.
None of us got a chance to see Matthew Vaughn's The King's Man.
But so Gabe did.
Oh, I'm sorry. Gabe saw it. Sorry. I take it back.
Gabe did more than that.
I did. I'll share a quick story. I think the film is really fun. I really liked it. If you like the Kingsman movies, I think you'll enjoy this, but it is different. It does set itself apart.
Is it better than two?
Yeah, I would say so. I've only seen two once. And I thought that was fun. I think if you like Matthew Vaughn's like slick style, it has that. But it sets itself apart. For anyone who doesn't know, it's an origin story to the Kingsman franchise, and it's about the establishing that sort of organization that we now know in the modern day setting. And because of that, it has a lot of runtime where it's not necessarily about that. Like, it's not necessarily immediately about the slick action and spies and all that stuff that the Kingsman are known for.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I'm curious as to if you agree with this sentiment. I've heard from multiple people that it feels like Matthew Vaughn wanted to make a World War One movie, and the only way he knew he'd be able to get the green light is by making it a Kingsman movie.
1,000%. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but that's what it feels like, because the World War One aspects of it, I think that it does, it plays with it and has fun with it. One thing that, you know, if you're a history buff or anything like that, the way he plays with sort of the world leaders at the time as characters and the sort of narrative around World War One is really interesting and intriguing. And it still feels like a Matthew Vaughn sort of, it has a bit of humor to it, even though it's very serious. But he treats sort of the, you know, he treats a lot of the serious nature of the war very seriously. Like his no man's land, like he has a no man's land scene or several scenes sort of set in that, in the trenches there. And they're not, he doesn't over stylize them, really. He takes them very seriously. And he has some really interesting, really striking and dark moments. The action is tremendous. I think he's an amazing action director. And I think a lot of people, you'd probably say he's before he was a director, he was a producer and he was working with Guy Ritchie. And it's his influence is very, however that partnership came to be, however, you know, whether they just both have the same sensibilities
Lock,
or not.
Snap.
It has, you know, he has that sort of very stylized action. I really enjoyed it. I thought that it, like I said, I thought it treated some of the bigger picture World War One sort of setting very seriously, and it very much feels like he wanted to treat it more like a traditional World War One movie in those moments. And that, for me, that helps it set apart. I will say the way it leaves it, this, I don't think this is a spoiler. There's no spoilers here, but talking about him as a producer, it's really fascinating that he now has a Kingsman franchise set in present day. And because this sets up that organization, the characters that we are left with at the end of this very much sets this up for a separate Kingsman franchise within its own time frame, which I think is to your
he's
point.
He's got it all mapped out too.
I think it's really brilliant from a producing standpoint. I think it's really brilliant how he's been able to create two franchises out of one franchise. I hope we get more of them, because I do like the period nature of him and kind of the way he's treating it and where it could go from here. Okay. I'll quickly, because there's a lot that we want to get to. And maybe I'll discuss this in a premium episode at some point if people want to hear more about it. I did get to visit the set of this. I only got to see one scene filmed, and then a lot of it was interviewing them and
is
visiting
that scene
some...
in the movie?
Yeah.
Was it?
Cool. I didn't even see.
Is that cool to watch? Like, did you it remember is. Seeing it's, it filmed?
The coolest thing was the I basically only saw one shot get filmed. And it's a oneer where it's a crane shot where it starts up, on a window of a building, and it comes down and it swoops into this sort of motorcade, and it lands on like a two shot of the people sitting in the car. It's a big Matthew Vaughn's kind of like oneer that gets you into a scene.
Awesome.
And so for the hours that I was sitting there, we pretty much, from what I remember, this was several years ago, 'cause this film got delayed and you go, you know, a year before it comes out and all that stuff. That was like the only thing that movement we really saw, because that's how long it takes to do those kinds of things. But it was very cool to see the camera's angle, having sort of sat in Video Village and kind of seen some of the angles that they had and see the workings of it was very cool. I have a bunch of stories about that whole trip that I feel like I've shared some maybe that I can share in a premium episode if people are interested in. But it was a great, it was very
pictures
awesome. I got to speak
or it
to the
didn't
whole
happen,
cast.
Gabe. You know, you keep talking about this Dr. Sleep set visit you
yeah,
did.
Let's not talk about pictures.
Lost the picture. Pictures or it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's a bummer. But I really enjoyed it. I think if you like the Kingsman franchise, you will like it. If you like Matthew Vaughn's style of action and you want to see him take a little bit more serious approach with some of it, he has some very, very interesting shots and sort of sequences of action. And this is an amazing fight scene in No Man's Land that is fantastic. But yeah, okay. I recommend it.
You sold me on it. I'll check it out.
I honestly really wasn't that intrigued to see it until...
I love the first one.
Yeah,
the first one's terrific.
Second one's crap.
All right, PTA's movie Licorice Pizza is expanding wide. If you want to hear Jake Hamilton's thoughts on it, he opened up about his take on it in episode number 192. So go back and see it. But then this week, Kevin and I were able to catch up with it. And Kev, why don't you take it away? Because I know you really liked it a lot.
Well, I'm a huge Paul Thomas Anderson fan, I think. Specifically of his more recent stuff, too. I mean, I grew up on Boogie Nights and Magnolia and Punch Drunk Love. But I mean, I've loved his different genre takes from over the years. And, you know, I don't love Inherent Vice as much as Sean does, but I love Phantom Thread. I love, you know, The Master. I absolutely love There Will Be Blood. This is like, I don't know. I just had so much fun with the characters. Like, the two leads, Cooper Hoffman and Alana, is it Alana? Alana Haim.
Haim, yeah.
Who obviously is the star of the film. And the idea behind the film is that Cooper Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman's son, which, by the way, he delivers a phenomenal performance.
He's so good. And, like,
what's cool about his performance is, like, you get little gestures or smirks that remind you of Philip Seymour Hoffman, but he really is his own actor. And so he's 15 in the film. He meets Alana Haim's character, who's 25. And the whole idea of the movie is this push-pull of her trying to not fall in love with him because he's 10 years younger. Mm-hmm. And I think the movie captures that in a way where I understand there was some controversy surrounding the idea of the age difference, but to me, the movie is about the idea of her fighting that aspect of it, mm-hmm. and kind of meeting this younger kid and kind of like them meeting at the wrong time in their lives because he's younger and she's older. But what's beautiful about this film in terms of, like, just from a writing standpoint, a cinematography standpoint, I just loved being in the world, and not much, like, happens from a story perspective, like, outside of, like, the basic arc of the story. I just liked spending time with the characters. Like, Benny mm-hmm. Safdie was amazing. There's a scene in this film that's probably top five my favorite scenes of 2021. And all I will tell you is that it's a large vehicle going down a street backwards. And it's so intense. Like, it kind of reminded me of how I felt watching the buttering of the toast in Phantom Thread. Like, it's a random sequence that somehow becomes so perfectly executed and intense. Yeah. I love that scene. It's my favorite scene in the whole movie. Basically, for people who, when you see it, Alana Haim and Cooper Hoffman are in a large vehicle and it's going backwards down the hill. It's awesome. But in terms of, like, the cinematography, I mean, obviously shooting on film, it looks beautiful. The soundtrack is fantastic. I wish Bradley Cooper was in it more because he was amazing. That quick, like, 10 minutes moment that he has in the film. Did they take out the scene where he, like, busts those windows? They put it in the actual credits.
Yeah.
But the most famous scene we saw is him, like, kind of like bending down and, like, breaking the glass. Like, they took that out of the movie, but they do give it to you in the trailer credits when they tell you who played who at the end. Where does this rank on PTA's list? I mean, it's interesting to me because, like, this is one of my favorite movies of the year. I don't know that it's his best movie ever, but I just loved the world. And I'm going to go see it again. They're playing it in 70mm up the street here, I think, on New Year's Day. So I'm going to go up and see it in 70. I want to see it on film before I kind of, like, get my full reaction or PTA ranking, but I loved it. But I also, you know, I want to, you know, this is a film that I think, has a lot of talking points. People have a lot of opinions about it. And I think everyone needs to respect everyone's opinions in terms of what worked and what didn't work for people.
Sure.
But for me, the film, I just loved being in the world, and, you know, spending time with these characters. And I think Cooper and Alana are absolutely phenomenal. Like, I fell in love with her immediately, and I don't know what it was, but there's just something about the way PTA captures her. It was just like, I was like in a daze. Like, I felt like Cooper's character does seeing her. And I think that's what really worked for me. So
he writes, PTA writes and creates and then casts, characters so perfectly.
Yeah.
And what you're saying, applied to this movie for me, but also that's what applies to Inherent Vice. I love the characters and I love the world of Inherent Vice.
That's it, yeah.
And I've completely understood that, you know, it took me a couple of viewings to even figure out what the hell was even happening in it, but I kept returning to just the vibe that he set up. But on the flip side, if you don't like the characters or you're not interested in the world, I could see it being pretty insufferable because it's a long ass movie that you have to enjoy being, you know, with these characters and spending a lot of the time, because as you say, not a ton happens, you know, it's mostly just sort of character beats that are coming through.
It's, and if you're not invested, movie.
For sure. Yes.
And like, I can see this that, you kind know, of his Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
If people don't love Dazed and Confused, if they think the characters are super annoying or, you know, they can't relate to them in any way, shape, or form, then that's probably a really tough movie to sit through.
Did you love it?
I loved it. Yeah, I really did.
Me too.
I'm not quite sure. I would have to see it again before I determine whether I love it enough to make it, like, a top 10 movie for me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's going to quite make the cut. But we were having this conversation about our top tens, and we're going to get into those in a little bit later. There's going to be some great movies that don't make my top 10 this year. Yeah. Like, this was a really strong year.
We also need to remind
year.
People that just because a film doesn't make... Because I have buddies of mine that will say, we'll talk about a movie and they'll say, oh, like, is it going to your top 10? And I go, no. And they go, oh, okay, so you didn't like it then. I'm like,
yeah.
Oh. We're allowed important... to love more than 10 movies this year. Like, that's astounding.
Very important side note. I want to thank or shout out PTA for not ever using licorice pizza in the movie, which was really cool. Because, like, sometimes you get that awkward scene where a character says the title and it pulls you out.
Yeah.
Licorice pizza, while we think it means the a vinyl, to me, it's the vibe of the movie. Mm-hmm. That's what the movie felt like. I don't know what that is or what licorice pizza, like, you know, outside of a vinyl is. But when it ended and the title card, whatever, I'm like, oh, I
was really hoping
title.
That we'd get like a Fantastic Four ending where like one of the characters would be like, you want pizza tonight? And the other character goes, yeah, what kind? And they look at each other and it cuts to black.
Thank God they didn't do that. I'm so happy there was no mention of the title. Unless I missed it. I didn't hear it.
Please
so.
Tell me that you're aware that I'm kidding whenever I...
No, I know you are.
Yeah. I know we are, yes. Speaking of confusing titles, The Matrix Resurrections is now in theaters and on HBO Max. I'll go first. This is such a disappointing movie. And I really... Well, I don't know if I really wanted to like it. I guess I was just curious. I was super curious why they were bringing this franchise back. If they didn't have what I thought was a justified reason for doing it. And the reason why it's so frustrating is that the first act sets up a lot of really interesting ideas, some really fascinating ideas about the meta existence of the Matrix by establishing, it's hard to get into this without kind of like spoiling some major things.
But I think,
like,
we can just keep this to reactions. We don't necessarily have to talk too much plot.
Okay. Yeah.
Just
that's
keep to
fair.
Your, how you feel about it and recommend it.
You know, we've been talking a lot about legacy sequels and bringing these original characters back. And Keanu Reeves just did it recently with Bill and Ted. Like, I thought it was more fun to see him back in Bill and Ted and going through those motions than I did seeing him try to revive Neo. And I put too much stock in the idea of a Matrix sequel, and it was when somebody finally said, like, someone said it in a way that they summed it up, and I was like, oh yeah, that's right. They were like, it's just another uneven sequel in the Matrix franchise. Like, all of them have been uneven. Every sequel that's come after the original has been chasing the high of the original, and none of them have gotten it. They all have something interesting going on in them. They all have really ridiculous things going on in them. And this is the exact same way. This is a movie that has some really interesting things. They just happen to be at the very, very beginning of it. And then it has a lot of really ridiculous things that happen in them. And the worst thing I can say about it is that it's boring. I was bored throughout it. There were multiple times throughout that movie where I just felt like this is taking forever. It's really not going anywhere. I don't dig what it's trying to do. And so I was really disappointed in it. I think I ended up going like 2 stars out of 5 because I did not appreciate it at all. Jakey, where are you at with it?
I liked it a little bit more than you, not as much to say that I liked it. I think the thing for me is that I was never once wowed by it, which say what you want to about Reloaded and Revolutions. I actually like Reloaded and Revolutions, but I think a majority of people would admit, even if they didn't like 2 and 3, there are some truly awe-inspiring moments. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the fight between Smith and Neo in the rain at the end of Revolutions. I love the freeway chase, and even though the CGI has aged poorly, I love the multiple Smiths in the park because I think the choreography on that is fantastic. Mm-hmm. There are some truly wow moments for those sequels, and I just didn't feel like there was a Matrix movie should not exist unless it wows me. You know, like it being, you know, a collection of decent enough action sequences is not good enough for a Matrix movie. It's just not. As much as I like Yahya Abdul-Mateen and Jonathan Groff as actors, they're not Morpheus and Smith.
Boom. That is exactly it. They're not this caliber. Like, Jonathan Groff is great, but he's not Agent Smith.
No,
and he can't replace Hugo Weaving.
And it feels cringy when they try to do it.
Yeah.
So bad.
And there are so many clips from the original trilogy that honestly just kept reminding me of movies that did what they're trying to do better.
Yeah.
A lot of clips of the first three movies thrown out in this one. And I just kept thinking, like, all you're making me do is want to go back and watch the first three. I do think The Hook is fascinating. I think their excuse for getting back into the story is brilliant, actually. And there are some really big swings, and I think any movie that takes big, giant, massive swings should only be knocked so much. Mm. But at the end of the day, I wouldn't go as far as saying it was boring, but I was never wowed, and for me, that's a big, giant swing, but also a miss for me on this one.
Also, sometimes it's even worse when a film is like just meh. Yeah, like mm-hmm. in a weird way, it's like I'm kind of where Jake is, where I didn't like the film, but I don't hate it as much as like a 2 out of 5 kind of thing.
Yeah.
But my problem with this film is exactly what Jake was just saying. Like at the end of the day, I can't tell you one memorable action scene or effects moment. And I'm not saying The Matrix has to do that, but they set a bar with the first one that was so high that there's no that's my dog barking. I apologize. Sorry. He gets upset when someone walks away. But anyway, so for me, it was like, I'm not saying you have to sit down and watch it, a Matrix film, and have an action scene delivered to you. It's going to blow your mind, like the bullet time sequences in the first one or whatever, or the highway scene in the second one. But there is something to be said about when you sit down for a Matrix film, what you do think you're going to get. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying that like a movie has to deliver exactly what the audience wants, or, you know, it's okay to flip the script and kind of do it differently. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, what blows my mind is that the 1999 film was so innovative and game-changing, and technology has advanced so much since that film, and nothing in this movie was anywhere near the level of innovation or game-changing aspects of what the 99 film did. And I think that is insane to me, because the techniques and the technology that we have now, like those, that movie pushed filmmaking forward in a way that was so innovative and unique. Like, you would imagine that, you know, all these years later, there'd be something invented technology-wise that would be able to take it to the next level. And it doesn't do that. And I think my problem with the film overall is it's too meta for its own good. Mm-hmm. And, like, I'm cool with meta.
It's almost a shame to be a Matrix movie.
Yeah, and I'm cool with meta aspects and things like that, but, like, the movie was trying so hard to deconstruct this idea of what we know as franchises, and there's a lot going on in this film we can't get into from a spoiler perspective, but it's trying so hard to be something that it, I don't know. I just found that to be frustrating, to be honest.
One more thing, I want you to tell me whether or not this is a silly knock, but to me, it sounds weird saying it out loud. To me, Neo should have short hair and be clean shaven.
Yeah,
no, yes. It's like, I'm just, sorry.
To me,
it's
it just
John
feels
Wick.
Like, yeah. To me, it just feels like it's Keanu Reeves saying, "Well, look, I got to film John Wick after this, right. So I'm not going to cut my hair."
Yes,
that's what I felt. Dude, like, that's probably what happened. That probably actually is what happened. Like,
it reminded me that he's Keanu Reeves and not Neo.
Yeah, I know. Also, that was a big thing. Took me out of it. Yeah.
Also, like, and I won't go into too much detail here, but there's like, they try to play around with like slow motion stuff again. And like, it just doesn't look as good or feel as natural. And like, yeah, there's a Neil Patrick Harris scene that I just thought didn't look good at all. And it was like a long scene. It just didn't look good to me.
My dad wants to watch it tonight. I'm curious to see how it holds up in a second run.
I'm watching it again tonight too, because Lauren hasn't seen it yet. So,
all right, well, let us know in the text thread whether it's any better the second time through. And since it's the end of the year and we're celebrating the holiday season, we wanted to play hashtag Holiday Movie Blend with our final blend game of 2021. Jake Hamilton, when it is the holiday season and you are home in Texas, what is the movie that you have to throw on, your favorite holiday movie, to make it feel like it is finally Christmas?
You know, I actually really look forward to, and I love this movie so much, but will only allow myself to watch it around Christmas time, post-Thanksgiving. Mm. I love Love Actually.
Oh,
I, nice. I love the collection of the stories. I love the needle drops. I love all of the actors. I love kind of like year for year sort of forgetting how they all interact with each other, because there's that fun crossover where they cross over into each other's stories. And sometimes I forget, oh, that's right, so-and-so is actually this person's sister, and this person is actually crosses over. I forgot about that. I really like that a lot. And it's one of those movies, and Sean, you said this early in the show one time, and I just love this quote so much, that movies don't change, we change. Mm-hmm. And I'm always curious as to how, as I get older and my perspective on life and my perspective on people, my perspective on relationships change, how my perspective on each individual story changes, and who mm-hmm. I relate to and who I feel bad for and who I cast as the villain. It's a movie that's ever evolving in my eyes. And it's just so Christmassy. It is such a Christmas movie. And in fact, one of the big needle drops is that the iconic Mariah Carey song. And also I love that score. I love the big score when all the stories are coming together and the little kid's chasing after the girl in the airport and Mr. Bean gets in the way and kind of winks and not. It's just, I truly, truly love that movie. And it makes me feel good to watch it every Christmas.
Awesome. I haven't seen it in a really long time. Like, I don't think I've sat down and watched it from start to finish. And,
it's hard to watch with the family because there's one plot line that involves stand-ins for porn.
Yeah.
And again, Kevin, I think we talked about this. They're not the porn actors. They're stand-ins.
Right.
Which apparently this is the most well-produced porn in history where they have to check out the lighting in advance with stand-ins.
Right.
But they're and they're people who are inherently shy around each other and also very like, but they happen to be stand-ins. At one point, I think Martin Freeman, who was the guy, says like, "Oh, I was a stand-in for Brad Pitt on 7 Years in Tibet." So he's like a professional stand-in, and he happens to be doing it for porn, and then they end up falling in love. My point being, it's not necessarily a gather a family, the entire family around.
Right. Well, let me remind you, my kids hate movies, so it'll be really easy for Michelle and I to watch it together.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, pop it back on. I would love to hear what you think years after having seen it.
All right, I'm gonna go, and my movie is more specifically a scene. And it's The Nightmare Before Christmas, and it's when Jack falls through the tree and he lands in the North Pole for the very first time.
What's this?
That is the moment where I finally feel like it is Christmas.
Have you watched it already this year?
No, I haven't had a chance to watch that scene just yet.
You're making me want to pop it on.
It's on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I feel like the holiday season is really catching up. Like it's I can't believe it's the end of this week. Like,
oh my god, and then it's done.
And then
it's over.
I know, it's really fast. But that scene, that song is tremendous. His sense of wonderment.
Yeah.
And then the way that they flip that story, Kev, I know that you're a huge fan of that movie, but the way that
he takes it back and
tries to apply Christmas, but can only do it through the lens of Halloween is just such a brilliant concept. And it's really
such
fantastic. But What's This is the scene that I throw on every single time because it reminds me.
I love, I think it's called Jack's Lament. When like he gets shot down and he's just sort of like, what? Like, I'm doing my best and none of these people. Oh my God, I love it. It's such, it's truly, truly, I'm amazed that they have not tried to turn it into a stage musical.
I saw Elfman do it live, actually.
Oh, see, that's awesome. See, we watched it with
whatever.
Like, we have Legally Blonde the musical, but not Nightmare Before Christmas the musical.
Yeah, that's kind of true. We have two numbers from Rogers the musical, actually. Yeah. Continue to watch Hawkeye.
Oh, I heard about
that. You know,
Elfman
does the singing voice for Jack, which is so cool.
Yeah,
like, to see him do it live. And because they have a different actor playing. I don't even know who the actor is who plays the talking Jack, which is interesting,
Tom Hanks.
By the way.
It was Tom Hanks.
Yeah, it's Tom Hanks.
Tom
Kev, what's your choice for Hollywood?
Real quick on The Nightmare Before Christmas. My mom and dad and brother and I went to New York when I was, probably when I was in college or maybe before college, and went to a MoMA Tim Burton exhibit, which was crazy because they had something he turned in school, like in fifth grade, and like the teacher saying how bad it was on it, and they had it in the museum. But the coolest thing I saw in the museum was this table that was covered in glass. It had like 30 or 40 different Jack Skellington heads on it, and all they were just the different changes of emotion.
God.
So like if Jack like started smiling, because remember this movie's film stop motion, so it's 24 frames a second, 24 shots a second, which is insane. Ugh. It could take weeks to film like 5 seconds of the movie.
It's crazy.
But in order to like for Jack to even smile, it could be five heads. Like you start from like the non-smile to the, it's unbelievable how they did that movie. Henry Selick is a great director. Most people think Burton directed it, which I always found interesting.
Whenever I ask people like, oh, what's your favorite Tim Burton movie? And they go Nightmare Before Christmas. I kind of want to be, you don't want to be that guy,
story.
But you kind of want to be like,
Did you see Coraline? That's the guy who did this. So mine, no question. Like, and weirdly enough, like it's the movie that I first put on in the holiday season. I've watched it twice already before Christmas is Home Alone. I mean, like at the end of the day, I watch both back to back. I always do both back to back.
Dude, how good is the pizza in Two look when he's in the limo?
Dude,
I always wanted
two,
that pizza.
I love Two. I don't care what anyone says.
I love Two. I think it's because I had the VHS of Two, and I never had the VHS of One.
Well, also, I like the New York setting.
Yeah,
I just like the idea of him being lost in New York. Isn't that the title? Lost in New York. I think it was. Yeah.
There's a great John Mulaney sketch about Like, how really? Are you lost in New York? It's a grid system.
That's funny. But every time I hear that John Williams score, it's immediately Christmas. Like, it's like, and Chris Columbus might be the, next to Rob Reiner, might be one of the most underrated directors of our time.
Yeah,
I mean, the guy
that.
Directed the first two Harry Potters, Mrs. Doubtfire, Home Alone 1 and 2. I mean, the guy, I mean, these are
iconic.
If
we're being honest, though. Those are the worst two Harry Potters.
They're the worst two Harry Potters, but
you're the
they
worst
did,
Harry
they
Potter.
They did jump the they were good movies. I mean,
they served their purpose. Yes, they served
their
purpose.
They were Alfonso Cuarón level. I mean, obviously, when Cuarón took over,
but the decisions that he had to make,
sure, yes,
were
fair,
like
fair.
And the degree to which he made them were pretty fantastic. But also, to be fair, those two books are the worst two books of the series.
That's fine. Yeah, that's
like
fine.
He made
well,
them
just acknowledging.
Probably, but he
just
made them as good as they could ever be.
Did he?
It's unfair. Yes. Yeah.
I thought he did a good job with what he had. They were kids
those
movies.
Stories,
those are kids movies.
I mean, the quote I always read was that the target audience for each Harry Potter story, whether it be the movie or the book, is whatever age the kids are in the story.
Okay. Yeah.
I can confirm. I was exactly the age as Harry Potter as they were coming out.
Gabe's a little wizard.
And he kind of looks like Harry Potter.
That's what people used to say. I used to wear round glasses, too.
You probably didn't even know who Cuarón was when you saw 3. It just blew your mind.
No, Gabe knew. Gabe knew.
I would say Gabe strikes me as the type who knows who Cuarón was.
No, that was probably my first Cuarón movie that I ever saw, I imagine. Wow. But yeah, no, I can definitely... I was going to defend those two because I was going to say those were not made
like
for the same two. Audience that the later ones are made.
Yeah.
I was the audience definitely at the time that those were made for, and they work. And so for me,
Columbus is like a
trip. They're great.
Yeah, Columbus is like a sleeper director. I just feel like he's like people don't appreciate.
Well, and,
I mean,
and he had to build.
Two.
He had to visually build that whole world.
Yeah.
So it's like that's the everyone else got to play with his tools. You know.
Mm-hmm. It's true. So, I mean, fair the enough. Dining hall. I mean, that's all. I mean, that's all him.
The
man.
John
like,
Williams
shots.
The cast itself, like all
the cast.
That.
Yes. Oh my God. I'm excited for that HBO Max reunion.
Same.
That should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I didn't
know
Home
this, Alone
but...
2. Home Alone 2 really feels to me like just the first
what?
Movie. Like,
no, it's what? Not.
You tread softly, sir. How
it's
dare
such
you?
Such a great idea. I love how they
They're
play with the concept.
The sticky bandits this time.
How do they how
Did
do
you
they
miss
even
that?
Get into
the first
that
they
story?
Were the wet bandits. Now they're the sticky bandits.
Okay. One fun thing to do, by the way, is if you watch the first and second Home Alone, watch every scene where Pesci and Stern get hurt and say to yourself, okay, they would have died here. Like when Pesci and Stern are getting the bricks thrown at them in 2, every one of those hits would have killed them immediately. It's like it's so those movies are so violent. They're so brutal.
I always forget. I rewatched one recently. I always forget like how little of the film is actually them trying to break in.
Yeah.
I always just associate that being the entire movie, but it's not.
It's a lot of him being home alone.
You know the spider story, obviously, right? Which is, that's a real spider on Stern's face, which is
good
the
Lord.
Most
Gabe's
right.
doing some
insane
sort of fun dance.
Audience
like an interpretive dance.
Kimberly Sue went with It's a Wonderful Life. That makes a lot of sense. Haley McCoy went with White Christmas.
They
Justin
chose
Shepherd.
Much classier films than us.
They did, yeah.
Also,
Justin
Chris
Shepherd.
Columbus is responsible for directing those black and white films in Home Alone. Angels with Filthy Souls and Angels with Even Filthier Souls.
Dirty
so
Faces.
Made
Get
dirty
that on your
knees,
you filthy animal.
Justin Shepherd said The Family Stone, John Augustine, David Cox, and many others went with Christmas Vacation. Saul Thomas said The Polar Express. Paul Marsh said Elf. Amanda Young said Home Alone, and lots of love for, weirdly enough, the Harry Potter franchise.
No, I do right know a lot of people Columbus. That associate Harry Potter with the holidays.
Well, I would like to thank everybody for participating in this week's Blend Game, and for all of the Blend Games that you guys did throughout the course of the year. It's always a lot of fun to chime in about movies that we enjoy. We're going to be recording our next premium episode next. It's dropping on Monday. It is the last mailbag of the year. So again, if you want to get access to this and all episodes of Real Blend Premium, go to cinemablend.com/RealBlendPremium. We put a post on Twitter and got a lot of really great questions. Gabe, did you see all those? Were you able to take note of the various questions that we got?
Yes, sir.
All right, good. Next Wednesday, we have our bonus episode with interview with Oliver Stone, who is talking about the director's cut of JFK, perfect for the holidays. That movie came out in December, by the way, too. He talks about in the interview how
so
he was like racing the clock to
I think 2 days ago was the The Scream anniversary, the 25th.
Did Django come out on Christmas?
Wes Craven. Hateful Eight definitely did too, didn't it?
Yeah.
Or around Christmas.
Christmas is a strange time for dark films. I mean, we have to remember that, like,
it's also, for a lot of people, it's not a movie coming out at Christmas. It's a movie coming out in December for the Oscar season.
When does West Side Story come out? I want to give a big thanks to the audience this year. You guys have been fantastic.
Do you guys notice that, though? We got a lot of dark films in Christmas. Like, Nightmare Alley is out now, and, like, it's a lot of dark stuff. Yeah.
I'm sorry, did Nightmare Alley come out?
Zing. This year, you guys have been really fantastic about supporting the show. Honestly, we can't thank you guys enough for the followers that we picked up on YouTube and the subscribers to the premium. We've seen those numbers go up, and just our download numbers have steadily climbed over the course of the year. And I know a lot of it is from the interviews, but there's been a significant number of people who have, like, weighed in after the fact and said, like, hey, I found you guys because of Quentin Tarantino, or tuned in for fill in the blank interview, and then I really enjoyed the conversation. So a big thank you to anyone who took the time at all to listen to the show, to share the show, especially friends, our friends and colleagues in the film industry, people in the industry out in Los Angeles, up in New York, who listen to us and helped us this year to book guests and to bring a lot of talent through here. All the crews that helped us record at the Junkets, who were really fantastic help with a lot of the talent that we're trying to get through, and also tell us a lot of times that they listen to us as well too,
and yell at us,
and sometimes yell at us, and then, you know, just in general for everybody who supports the show, we're so thankful to be able to do it. You know, we joke about how the fact that, you know, we get together every single week to talk about movies, it's something that we would do, you know, without a podcast. So this has been a lot of fun to see this evolve for the four of us as a show that we kicked off as a temporary awards conversation, and one where we would never have interviews. This has really turned into something else that we never dreamed possible, and a lot of it is because of you guys. So we'll meet you back here in 2022, but also make sure that you check out the Oliver Stone interview, and if you're a premium listener, you'll have a couple of things waiting for you this season. So until next year, then, with a new episode. Well, hold on. You can listen to us or follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and at Real Blend. I feel like I need a better thing to yell. I need a new thing
Killers
for 2022.
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Sure, why not? Let's make it that. Happy New Year, everyone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there another director you'd like to get on the show?
No, that'd be fine. He can come on.
No, we're not getting a Hubie director on the show.